Hello, and green blessings.
Hello, Susan. This is Justine.
Hi, honey. How are you?
I'm good. How are you tonight?
Oh, wonderful. We're so enjoying our Green Goddess Week.
Oh, I'm so glad that you are. You are having perfect weather for it, too.
We certainly are.
We saw your article in the e-zine about the wild bergamot tincture, and that looks fabulous. Anybody who's listening can go to wisewomanmentor.com, and there you can click on the link for the Wise Woman Herbal e-zine, and right there you'll get the recipe for that and some beautiful photographs too. And tonight we're going to have a guest on later at 9. Her name's Elizabeth Joyce, and she is a psychic and a twin. So that's going to be probably a pretty interesting interview tonight. You have your list of questions for that, Susan?
Oh, I'm sure it's around somewhere. I'll have it by 9.
Okay, good. Well, there's the heads
up. Pretty back-to-back day here.
Either Elizabeth will be calling in or I will be calling her, and you will be interviewing her. I can also fax this over while we're talking. I also have a bunch of questions that people sent in by email. It seems like more and more people are sending in questions by email, which is good, I guess, now. And if anybody calls in, we'll be happy to answer your question live as well. Shall we dive right in with the first question?
Yes, let's do it.
Okay. Hi, I'm new to your site. I wanted to know if you have a remedy for crepe skin. I have it on my arms, belly, and top of thighs. I'm 60, weigh 103 pounds. Any help would be appreciated. Thank you for your wisdom.
Well, what you're talking about is a normal consequence of aging. What happens as we get older is that we produce less collagen. Collagen is a substance that plumps up the skin. And as we produce less collagen, we find ourselves getting wrinkly and crepey everywhere. So the real solution, and I am saying this very tongue-in-cheek, to crepey skin is just to die. Because it's just going to get worse. You're just going to get older, and it's going to get worse and worse and worse. So if it's bothering you now, you should just check out. But again, I'm being really facetious. Of course, I don't want you to do that. I want you to be comfortable with your body as it is. How much you weigh is meaningless to me because I don't know if you're 5'2" or 6'10". If you're 6'10", you weigh 103 pounds, you need to be in the hospital. And it's a serious underweight. Losing a lot of weight can make your skin crepey. So I don't know why you told us how much you weigh. It's kind of a weird piece of information for me because I can't connect it to anything except that it sounds very low. It's a very low number, and it makes me uneasy to hear a woman say that she weighs so little. But again, I don't know. You could be, you know, really, really short, and then it would be okay. Now, comfrey leaf infusion helps to build elasticity, flexibility, and strength in the skin. I am not telling you that comfrey will cause you to make more collagen, but I am telling you that it will cause your skin to be healthier. It will cause the blood flow to the skin to be far richer, and although you will still have some crepiness, your skin will glow with health. And really, isn't that what we're interested in? We're not so interested in, you know, do we have this kind of mark of beauty or not? But are we healthy? That's what I personally am attracted to in people. Not if they're thin, as you see, thinness kind of puts me off. I don't like bony people at all. I'd like a little padding on my woman. Thank you very much. And It doesn't really matter other than that. As long as there's some padding, it doesn't matter how much she weighs or how she does her hair or whether she wears lipstick or high heels or not, although I certainly prefer not, but I'd go with that. What I really want is vitality and energy and a feeling of health. And drinking and nourishing herbal infusions is guaranteed to give you that health.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Well, we have a similar topic for our next question here. I'm looking for information for possible salves. Started making tinctures from learning herbs. That's who suggested I write to you. My daughter has psoriasis all her life, under control and noticeable, but recently had a large outbreak, and it's unpleasant to say the least. Looking for advice.
Goodness, there was a correspondence course student who wrote me about a month or so ago, asking me to write back about psoriasis, which her husband was dealing with. And I'm kind of seeing if I can dredge up out of my memory, because I, you know, referenced the several books and looked for it. And a little bit is coming back. But what I will do is I will pull up that letter that I wrote to her, take her name off of it, and then send that letter over to Justine and the Wise Woman Web, and they will forward it to you. So you will have the information on psoriasis. Basically, what we're talking about is a condition in which the skin grows very rapidly. And it grows so rapidly that the top layers are constantly sloughing off. And then the underlayers, which look red and raw, are exposed. And it can be painful and it can be itchy. And, of course, we can do palliative things. And many people think that it is related to stressors. Well, gosh, most of our health is related to stressors, isn't it? So that certainly makes sense. And so what you said that your daughter was suddenly had an outbreak. What kind of stressor was going on? This is one of the questions that we teach all of the students if they are working with people who have problems, is to say, what happened right before this problem happened? If you don't know what happened, Mom, find out from your daughter what happened. You don't say, or I didn't hear, how old your daughter is, but you know there's always the possibility with a daughter that something has happened that has been very upsetting to her, that she feels reluctant to share with you. Push her a little bit and see what comes out, and I'll get the letter that I wrote to you with some help.
Okay, great. Thanks. I have someone here who's called in and has put up the question mark, so let me unmute them. Hi there in the 720 area code. Do you have a question for Susan this evening?
Actually, I just wanted to share a little story and then maybe a little question.
Okay, great. Go right ahead.
Go right ahead.
Okay, hi, Susan. Thanks for taking my call. I am very new to learning about herbs, and through my Google search, I came across you. And so I've been obsessed, and I've been watching a ton of YouTube videos. And I was watching an interview that you did with Barry Louise Switzen. And in that, you sang a little song about the linden flower. And as you were singing it, I immediately knew that the tree in my front yard was a linden tree. And I turned to my husband and I said, instinctually, I know it's a linden tree. And he kind of rolled his eyes. And I Googled and found the pictures of the tree, and it is a linden tree. And I have no idea how I knew that, because I couldn't identify anything. So
I know how you knew that.
Unbelievable. How?
I know how you knew. The tree told you.
It did. It really did. When you said smells like
berries. Linden tree told you. It has nothing to do with instinct. Intuition,
wow.
Maybe. Openness, heartedness, connection, yes. The tree told you.
Well, it was awesome, and I'm so excited. And my question is there anything I can harvest now? The flowers are gone.
All parts of the linden have uses, so there is certainly something you could harvest now, but the question is, do you want it? So the bark is used for making rope. But I don't suspect that you would want to make rope.
No.
So you probably wouldn't want to harvest the the bark to make rope out of.
No.
The leaves can be used, and they make a very good healing poultice, especially when they're fresh. So if you or anyone you know falls or gets an injury or a scrape or a cut, you could use a fresh linden leaf as a poultice.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, about 5 years ago, at the Green Goddess Week, or the Green Goddess Week this week, a woman came who had just been at a horseback riding camp, and a horse had kicked her, and the shod metal-covered hoof of the horse contacted her leg at the ankle and then went all the way up to her knee. And it took, a 2 or 3 inch strip of skin off the entire way. And the people at the camp were very concerned, and so they took her to an emergency room where they put antibiotic ointment on it and then some gauze. And, of course, by the time she got here, the wound was looking pretty nasty. It was red. It was looking very infected. Now, I don't know, because I've never used antibiotic ointment in my life, but I will tell you that dozens of doctors have told me that if you want to guarantee that a wound doesn't heal, you put antibiotic ointment on it. And that it will almost certainly prevent the wound from healing, and that it does nothing to counter infection. And the MDs that I know don't even understand why antibiotic ointment is sold at all. So, as a matter of fact, one of these MDs came to study with me specifically to create an herbal alternative to antibiotic ointment because she was so fed up with how nasty it was on wounds. So we had her gently wash her leg, get the gauze off, get the antibiotic ointment off, gently wash her leg. And then because we were sitting under a linden tree, I said, let's each pick a linden leaf, chew it up, and put it on her wound. And we each did. And she's thinking, oh, my gosh, you know, first they're taking me to the hospital, because it was just the previous day, taking me to the hospital, and they're putting all this stuff on, and now this weird woman is pulling it off and washing it off and sticking tree leaves on. Right, and this was, about 1, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And that night at dinner, at 6 o'clock, she pulled up her pants and she said, look at this. And the leaves, of course, had dried and pretty much fallen off, but there was no more redness around the edges of the wound. Even though linden isn't considered an anti-infective, it's just such a powerful healer that it helped to clear the infection, and you could see that the wound was actively starting to heal. Now, you were going to ask something about the linden leaves?
Yeah, the long, skinny green one. Can I take those and
that's
use
not
those
a leaf.
For an infusion?
Excuse
okay.
me, that's not a leaf.
Okay.
It's part of the flower.
So can I, now that the flowers are dead, but that part is left, can I use that for an infusion?
You could use it, but I think the salient question here is, would you get the effect you want? And the answer is no.
Okay.
There is a reason that a tree that grows all over the world, people all over the world use the flowers, right?
Yes.
So again, sure, you can use any part of it, but are you going to get what you want from it? What I want from linden is the anti-inflammatory effects. And what I know from hundreds of thousands of people in cultures as diverse as France, Germany, China, everywhere that linden grows, people say, use the flower. Now, the flower includes that thing that you were calling a leaf, which is not.
Okay.
The leaves are heart-shaped, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So that little strappy thing is part of the flower, and when you harvest the flower, you harvest it with that strappy thing.
Okay, so I'll wait till next year.
You can buy it. It's an item of commerce. You can use linden now. I buy plenty of linden. I never rely exclusively on what I harvest.
Okay. All right, well, thank you so much.
Linden, linden, heal my heart. You can bring me a brand new start.
All right.
Thank you. I've been drinking Linden and enjoying it quite a bit, in fact.
Our infusion today, too, is Linden.
Yay. So we have another person here who has a question live in the 812 area. Are you there? Would you like to speak with Susan tonight?
Yes, I am here. Thank you so much. My question has to do with a situation I encountered recently with my daughter, who just had a baby a month ago. And she's nursing her baby, but she's also been dealing with hemorrhoids. And as we were looking at herbal salves that were comforting for her hemorrhoids, we found that many of them had astringent herbs. In the end, we decided that and this was her decision as well as mine, but that maybe it would be all right for her to go ahead and use those because her milk supply is so copious that it didn't seem like there was much danger of the astringent herbs affecting her milk supply. But it did get me thinking, you know, it's like how might we best support a new mother who's dealing with hemorrhoids at the same time that she's nursing, considering that the astringent herbs that are so wonderful to use for hemorrhoids can be contraindicated for breastfeeding.
Well, I'm a little confused by what you're saying.
Okay.
Are you considering drinking astringent herbs?
No, using them as a salve.
Then how on earth is it going to get in her breast milk? How on earth is it going to affect her breast milk?
Well, my thought was that, you know, when you take a salve, you know, just trying to err on the side of being safe, when you take a salve, it does enter the bloodstream. And so I was imagining that it might eventually affect her.
You take, so, in other words, if you put on antibiotic ointment, there's going to be antibiotic in your bloodstream? Not that I know of.
Oh, that's, well, that was my understanding. Perhaps I'm mistaken.
Not that I have ever heard in my life.
I'm always concerned about what I put on my skin. Like even, like, you know, shampoos and things like that. I'm always thinking that they must eventually, you know, enter into my body in a way that could interact with other parts of me, not just where I put it. But what you're saying is comforting. I mean, and as I said, we did go ahead and use the salves, and she had a great result from them and didn't see any difficulty with her breast milk. But I just wanted to get a second opinion about it.
Well, there's my opinion. It's unlikely that anything you put where hemorrhoids occur is going to get to where her breasts are. Quite a distance in between.
Okay.
In fact, this is one of the reasons why postmenopausal women who are bothered with vaginal dryness sometimes choose to use an estrogen cream vaginally because it doesn't get into the bloodstream. And that's in the vagina.
Well, I've taken bioidentical progesterone cream.
Oh, for goodness sakes, and you're worried about what you put in your body? What are you doing?
Well,
I
haven't done it in years, but I have done it in the past.
Well, don't ever do it again. And tell every woman never to do it. They're not bioidentical. A cortisone that a doctor gives you is made in the same way that that progesterone you were using. Would you consider cortisone safe and bioidentical?
No, I certainly would not.
Made by exactly the same process from exactly the same plants. Dr. Lee, who started the whole thing about progesterone cream, says, and I quote, in the laboratory, we synthesize real human progesterone. What's wrong with that statement?
Right. Well, obviously. But I guess what I'm saying is that that did enter my system, right?
Put it on your belly, right?
Yeah.
Put it right over your ovaries, yo! Yeah, it does. In a 3-month study of women using the amount that's suggested, which is 100 times more than is safe to use, a huge percentage of those women had preliminary cancerous changes in their uterus.
Well, I guess saying that that's why I was concerned about a salve, because I think that...
Wait a second. You're using a lethal hormone. We cannot compare that to an astringent herb. That's like saying, I'm afraid to cut my bread with a knife because somebody was shot at the shopping mall. There is no bio-identical hormone. Progesterone cream is lethal to women. The fact that you used it frightens me and appalls me and makes me question what you said about being, you know, concerned about what you put on your body. And I hope that you spread the word to many, many other women to stay as far away from anything called bioidentical as possible. As a matter of fact, the National Women's Health Network says that bioidentical hormones are new age snake oil. The Food and Drug Administration has declared over and over again that bioidentical hormones are more dangerous than other hormones. Because they're not truly bioidentical, they are synthetic.
Mm-hmm.
So you simply cannot compare that to an herb. It's like saying, I put cortisone on my knee and it got in my bloodstream, so now I'm afraid to use herbs. Well, cortisone is not herbs, is it?
I certainly don't think so. And that wasn't my intention.
Progesterone is not herbs either.
Yeah. I'm not disagreeing with you about that.
Good. I'm glad you've stopped. Please don't start again. Please warn other women. In my book, New Menopausal Years, The Wise Woman Way, I talk about the dangers of progesterone cream. Dr. Lee said, oh, well, the women who use progesterone cream had better bone mass. And, you know, at first I bought it because that's what he was saying. But then I said, let me see the studies. And the fact of the matter is that the women that he worked with didn't have a uterus, therefore they didn't have any risk of uterine cancer from using a progesterone cream, and the vast majority of them didn't have their ovaries either. And he asked them not to smoke, not to drink alcohol, to eat leafy greens on a daily basis, and to exercise. Do you think any of those things would have any influence on your bones?
Right.
In fact, those things are far more important to bone mass than any so-called junk cream.
All right. Well.
Next question.
Thank you for calling in.
And the next question is?
Yep. I was reading your recent article titled Herbal Remedies for STDs and STIs, and I'm curious about the findings contained in the article, especially regarding herpes. I am curious about the use of hypericum perforatum tincture and the burdock and echinacea root brew as an effective way to eliminate the disease. I am curious to know your personal experience with these findings. If you don't mind sharing, thank you so much.
One of the first people that asked me to help her with herpes was a woman over 30 years ago who was pregnant and was being told that she was not going to be allowed to give birth vaginally because she had herpes. And she said, but it's not active. And they said, well, we can't be sure that it won't become active during the birth and labor and delivery. And she's like, you know, saying, this is crazy. I want to give birth. I don't want to have my baby cut out of me because I have herpes. Now, obviously, you know, the situation has relaxed a lot about it. But at this point, people were very hysterical about letting women give birth vaginally if they had herpes. And so she came to me and she said, the only way that my doctor will let me give birth without a C-section is if I can eliminate the herpes from my blood. And I said, ooh, that's kind of a tall order. Because it's not really easy to eliminate from the blood. And we worked with the burdock echinacea brew that you're talking about. And she and her husband drank it. And she started drinking it, I think she was about 5 or 6 months into the pregnancy. And she drank it right up until when she gave birth vaginally because they couldn't find herpes in her blood. So that's my semi-personal experience. I personally don't have herpes, so I've never had occasion to try it.
All righty. Thank you. The next one here. Are you still there, Susan?
I am.
Okay. I am in the process of making hawthorn berry tincture to help support my high blood pressure condition. I know you love that wording, don't you?
Well, and it makes me wonder why she wants to support high blood pressure. But
I'm sorry. I'll try to paraphrase these in the future.
It's okay.
And I have a few. Whoops. And I have a few questions which I'm hoping you can help me with. I combined equal parts flower, leaf, stem, and berry, a quarter pound each, into a jar and added 1,183 milliliters of 50-50 grain alcohol and water, 1 to 5. I've let it macerate for 6 weeks, and the berries are still hard and haven't lost much of their color. The liquid has more of the brownish color from the leaves, although recently I'm seeing cloudy swirl, which I'm guessing is from the berries. My questions are, should I have crushed the berries before tincturing them? Is 6 weeks long enough for the berries to extract, or should I wait longer? Next time, I would make it more sense to tincture the berries and flowers separately? If so, how long for each? Thanks in advance for your help. I appreciate it. I listen to your radio show and really enjoy it.
I tincture dried hawthorn berries, but I don't mix leaf and flower in with it at all, ever. When I tincture the hawthorn berries, I fill any size jar about one-third full of dried hawthorn berries. And I never, ever, ever use grain alcohol. I'd be happy to talk about why I would never use grain alcohol, but let me finish this. So I fill a jar approximately one-third full with dried hawthorn berries. If it's a little less or a little more, it really doesn't matter. I have no way without a calculator to compute how much alcohol you used, and I would never calculate it or measure it. I simply fill a jar about a third full and then fill the jar to the top with 100-proof vodka, and I only use 100-proof vodka to make my tinctures. I then let my hawthorn berry tincture sit for 12 months before I use it. When I first started reading herbals, and there weren't many out in the mid-60s when I became interested, basically what we had was U.S. Pharmacopeia advice about making tinctures, and because it's U.S. Pharmacopeia, they want to use grain alcohol because it's very, very high proof, and because then it can be diluted with a variety of different amounts of water to make, as you made, a half and half, which is not the equivalent of 100-proof vodka at all or any other proportion. And this also requires the drying of the herb. But interestingly enough, in U.S. Pharmacopeia, the herb is almost always ground into a very fine powder and then put into a lined funnel. And the grain alcohol percolates through, much in the way that you might make drip coffee. So it was never, so far as I could tell, intended for the herb to actually sit in grain alcohol. Now, I live in a state, New York State, where grain alcohol is illegal. You can't buy it, and you can't sell it here. Why would a state make grain alcohol illegal? Because it's lethal. I am certainly not advising on lifestyle, when I say that you can drink a quart of vodka a day with no bad consequences. Well, as a matter of fact, a great many people who live in Russia do drink a quart or a liter, it would be there, of vodka on a daily basis. Vodka means water. I personally found in my college days, because I'm not a drinker and don't enjoy drinking, not even wine, that it was very difficult to have any social life because everybody else was drinking. And I found that I could have a glass of tomato juice or a glass of orange juice with some vodka in it, and not only would I be considered adult and sociable, but I could—I didn't have to have more than that one drink because it was a big drink for the whole evening, and that I suffered no consequences from the vodka. I mean, a glass of wine makes me feel like I've been run over by a car, and then the next day I feel like I've been run over by a truck. My body just does not enjoy alcohol at all, but the vodka's okay. One of my students called and said, my 80-something-year-old mother, because I'll say 86, my 86-year-old mother is an alcoholic. What can I do? And I said, your 86-year-old mother is an alcoholic? Did she just get into drinking? She said, no. She's been an alcoholic since she was 14. I'm like, what? You're telling me your mother has been an alcoholic for more than 70 years? How's her liver? She says, the doctor says her liver is great. I'm like, oh, this surpasses understanding. You actually telling me that your mom gets drunk on a regular basis? She says, almost every day. So your mom's been getting drunk almost every day for 60 years now, and her liver is fine. She said, yeah, the doctor says it's because she only drinks vodka. So here we have, on one hand, grain alcohol, which is lethal. A quart a day in 4 days will kill you dead. And on the other hand, vodka, which means water, which appears to have little to no effect on the liver. Guess which one I'm going to choose to make my tinctures.
Wow, that's pretty important information for us to know, isn't it?
That's why I use vodka.
Yep.
And I find that by using the 100-proof vodka, no, you can't use 80-proof, it has to be 100-proof, that I get a mixture of both water-soluble and alcohol-soluble constituents that is very, very different from a tincture made with grain alcohol. As a matter of fact, I've done tincture tests with people nose-to-nose, my tincture with the vodka and their tincture with the grain alcohol, and about 90% of the time, people vastly prefer the tincture made with the vodka. There's something about grain alcohol.
Yeah, more pleasant to the mouth, for sure.
Much more pleasant, right? And, of course, I sometimes use tinctures externally, too, and I don't want to be putting grain alcohol on my skin.
Mm.
So, in short, I wouldn't tincture leaves, flowers, and berries all together in one thing. I make infusion from the leaves and flowers of hawthorn and tincture from the berries.
Yeah, and
I let the berry
like
tincture from dried berries sit for a full year. Yes, I use water for the leaves and flowers and make an infusion and drink it. I weigh out 1 ounce, put a quart of boiling water over it in a jar, let it steep for 4 hours or overnight, strain it and drink it.
There you go.
And that's because in general, I also never would make a tincture from a dried flower or a dried leaf. If I'm going to make a tincture of a leaf or a flower, it must always be fresh.
Certainly makes a much better tincture.
Doesn't it, though? I mean, you've seen the difference.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's not even a comparison. It's just night and day.
Yeah.
All right, next question. I am in need of a wise woman experience. I'm growing a plot of alfalfa, and there's a lot of pigweed coming up. I did some research and found out that it's amaranth, and I want to know if it's edible. I thought I might pull it up, but then something told me I might learn more from the situation. Maybe I could pull up half of it. Do you have any experience with spiny pigweed that you could guide me on? Should I meditate on a leaf I've picked? I would love to learn to communicate with the divas of the plant world. Thank you for any direction and guidance that you're willing to share. I learned about you from reading the brochure on the Women's Herbal Conference in North Carolina. My wife loves it and intends to return this year. Sounds great. Sorry that men are not able to participate. But I'm thankful that women have a place and a time to celebrate women's wisdom and love of the earth and plants.
The International Herbal Symposium, which takes place every other year in Wheaton, Massachusetts, usually in late June, of course, invites men. There are other herbal conferences that invite men, so you don't need to be sorry that men don't get to come to a women-only gathering, because it's really important for women to have a safe space to be in. So that kind of caught my attention. And then what came just before that?
Pigweed. Spiny pigweed.
Spiny pigweed. I don't have any particular experience with spiny pigweed. The Pigweed, of course, is a common name that refers to a great number of different plants, so I'm glad that she has said that it's amaranth, because otherwise we really wouldn't know what she was dealing with. I'm more concerned with the alfalfa. I would probably pull up the alfalfa and leave the amaranth, in fact. But that's because I'm a goat keeper, and if you feed goats alfalfa, they die. So I've never much liked alfalfa, and I don't think that it's a particularly good crop. I'm far more in favor of clover as a crop. So as far as I'm concerned, you're growing a field of amaranth, and the alfalfa's in the way. Now, pulling up plants is not the way to be in touch with a diva. There's a group in Italy that has wired plants to computers so that the plants can control things. And they put a plant in a room with a door that could be locked and unlocked, and the plant, being hooked up to the computer, could lock or unlock the door. And when people approached the room thinking about pulling plants up or harming plants, the plant locked the door. So I have to tell you, if you're thinking of pulling up even one plant, the divas are not going to talk to you and the plants are going to lock the door. I harvest amaranth by cutting it. The stalk as well as the leaves is edible, but only before the amaranth flowers. I rather suspect that yours has already flowered, although I don't know. We harvested amaranth today and we had it for dinner. Amaranth leaves are one of my favorite cooked greens. If your amaranth has already flowered, then what you need to do is wait patiently until it makes seeds. And once my amaranth has made seeds, then I go out with a bowl, usually a stainless steel bowl or a plastic bowl, and I take the amaranth seed head and I kind of bend it over and shake it in the bowl and get the little bitty black seeds out. And you're also going to get some of the chaff, and you'll have to sort the chaff from the seeds. It can be a little bit tedious harvesting your own amaranth, but then you can put that in a cast iron frying pan and pop it and then cook it in with other grains. Both the grain and the greens of the amaranth are highly nutritious. As a matter of fact, amaranth greens are very unusual in that they contain all essential amino acids. So amaranth greens are a complete protein. They are considered to be the healthiest food in the world. Now you see why I say that the alfalfa is in the way of your amaranth. Get rid of the alfalfa and let the amaranth grow. All right. Eating amaranth leaves is even better than eating kale.
All right. And then there was actually, this is a very long, long letter, and there was at the beginning, I only read the first sentence of the first three paragraphs, and it explains that the alfalfa is being grown to break up the clay in the soil and to bring up minerals from deeper in the earth.
Clover does it better.
All right. Red clover, yeah, and brings in the bees and the butterflies, too.
Exactly, exactly. It's very difficult to find alfalfa seed that does not come pelletized with chemicals already on it.
Wow. Interesting.
Very difficult to grow alfalfa seed, very tricky crop to grow, a tiny little seed. So about 99% of all alfalfa seed is sold pelletized with herbicide on the pellet.
Probably from Monsanto, right?
Who knows?
Anyhow,
and you know what? The amaranth is bringing up more subsurface minerals than the alfalfa is. Again, the alfalfa is just in the way of the amaranth. Get rid of the alfalfa. Keep the amaranth.
There you go. That's the message, right?
Right.
All right. So the next question here. From the bottom of my heart, I want to thank you for your books and information online, Susan. I started drinking oat straw and nettle infusions, a quart a day, 2 weeks ago, and have noticed a huge change in my energy and nervous system. I am starting to feel truly nourished for the first time in my 40 years, and I'm so grateful for this new way of helping my body. I am devouring your books. I have two questions I thought you might be able to answer on your radio show, and I'm sure you're very busy, and I imagine others have the same questions. I apologize if you already answered them. You have a lot of info out there, and I've not been able to find what I need yet. I want to support myself nutritionally through healing from severe depression, daily panic attacks I experienced this year. I use an antidepressant, Lexapro, which helps dramatically, and I'm still using it, but I hope to be able to come off it within a year. I'm confused about what to eat and what not to eat to help my body brain to stay healthy. There are people working with brain disorders, autism, depression, bipolar, who swear by a grain-free, legume-free, sugar-free diet. They feel that even with soaking and sprouting, that grains and legumes are not healthy. Now, when I read some of the testimonials, they're very dramatic and persuasive. I've heard you say to eat a wide variety of foods, and I really value your opinion, so I'm wondering if you could comment on these diets and why you think they are or are not wise to follow. Is there a way you would recommend to eat to support these issues? I've started eating animal fat, cultured veggies every day, and I'm happy to drink more infusions if you feel it's necessary.
A quart a day is a good amount. I don't think that you need more infusion. And I just recorded 4 half-hour shows on herbs for anxiety and depression for Time Monk Radio. Is it possible that we could send this woman a link to those shows?
I'm sure that we could. Kim goes through the show after the end every week and sends all the people a link to the show that we've answered questions for, and she'll hear this. So, yes.
Yeah.
Time Monk Radio.
Time Monk Radio. Now, the shows haven't aired. I just recorded them last night.
So she'll just contact them and find out.
Just contact them, and it's 4 half-hour shows for the first week of August, second week of August, third week of August, fourth week of August, right? So it's a month's worth of shows.
Exciting.
But I can certainly, I'm not trying to withhold information, just to say you get 2 full hours of information there, which I think would be very helpful for you. In general, I think you're making very good dietary choices. The nervous system and the brain needs cholesterol from animal products, and I'm very happy to hear that you're increasing the amount of animal fat and the amount of animal products in your diet. And if eating less grain and less beans means that you eat more animal products, then certainly it's okay with me if you eat less, but to eat none. Anytime somebody says, don't have anything in your diet, I got to say, my eyebrows go up. I got to wonder how it is that the staple foods of this planet, grains and beans, somehow have become unwholesome for us. And it gives me a little shiver of, oh my, how sad, how terrible. Sacred Corn Mother. Corn is grain. Grain is the basic food of all humanity. In every culture, grain is a mainstay. Whether it's wheat or rice, whether it's corn or millet, whether it's rye or the associated non-grain seeds that are used like grain, kasha, quinoa, amaranth. These are the mainstays of the human diet. Eating whole grains on a daily basis is certainly one of my goals for health. I do my best to eat only whole grains and to avoid processed food. But if I'm at someone's house and they serve processed food, I would probably eat it. Certainly, I've had enough experience eating that to know that when I eat a flour product that has been enriched, like rolls or bread or crackers or pasta, that I can feel very different changes in my body that have to do with my body not making B vitamins anymore. And so, I probably wouldn't eat a lot of it, even, though I was eating some, to be polite, find that those synthetic vitamins just are not healthy for me. And so You didn't mention whether or not you take any supplements, and I hope you don't. If you are dealing with any kind of issues of anxiety or depression or any kind of health issues, I would recommend that you take no supplements of any kind. I went into some detail about some of my favorite plants to help relieve anxiety and depression, including motherwort, lemon balm, hypericum, passion flower, and marijuana. Now, you may live in a state where it's illegal, and I certainly wouldn't want to get you into trouble, or you may live in a state where it's legal, and you could, in fact, get a prescription, for it's a well-known way to relieve depression. And, of course, marijuana is an herb that's been in use for thousands of years, and I'm glad to have lived long enough to see it coming back into use. Motherwort, I use the flowering tops of the tincture. And Justine and I just made the greatest YouTube. She wound up with a field of motherwort this year. And you see me, you know, literally in this field of motherwort, making a motherwort tincture. It's so beautiful. It's such a great experience. Thanks, Justine, for making that YouTube. It's really a delicious memory for me. And you'll find us talking about it. I really love motherwort as a way to relieve anxiety. And if I'm in a situation where I think I'm going to be anxious, I'll just get up in the morning and take a dropper full of motherwort. You know, like if, gee, there's 1,000 people here and I'm supposed to lead the ceremony tonight, well, probably a dropper full of motherwort first thing in the morning would help me be a little, you know, more stable during the day. Motherwort is a mint, and lemon balm is a mint as well, and lemon balm tincture can also be useful to relieve anxiety. And if you're concerned about whether or not these herbs would be safe to use with your drug, don't ask your doctor about the herbs, because most doctors don't have any training in herbs. Not their fault. And know little to nothing about them. And so rather than asking your doctor about the herbs, ask your doctor if it would be okay to drink a cup of mint tea while you're taking your drugs. And if the answer is yes, well, that mint tea is actually stronger in its own way than motherwort tincture or lemon balm tincture. So those would be perfectly fine to take. Marijuana can also be tinctured, again, but only if it's illegal in the state that you live in, and that tincture used to help relieve anxiety. I have, when I'm in a state where it's legal, enjoyed having some, again, in situations where I might be going, oh my goodness, you know, what's going on here? And a very dear friend of mine who was on some pretty severe drugs for anxiety and depression was able to get off of her drugs within a two-month period by using marijuana tincture. And yes, she lives in a state where it's legal. We wouldn't want you to do anything that would get you in trouble. So we'll send you a link to the four shows so you can get the lowdown on all of these things. But here's a few things for you to think about and to start considering right now. I also mentioned on the show that Dr. Tiarona Kalar Lodog, did her own meta-study. She's an herbalist and an MD. She's the kind of MD who does know a lot about herbs. And so she did a meta-study, which is a study of studies. She found all of the studies that had been done on Hypericum perforatum, sometimes known as St. John's wort, although I prefer to call it St. Joan's wort, as compared to antidepressive drugs. And she found that in mild depression, Hypericum was far better and far more effective and far faster working than drugs. In moderate depression, Hypericum was better, faster working, and more effective than drugs. In severe depression, Hypericum was better and faster working than drugs. So there is no depression, whether it's mild, moderate, or severe, that is not relieved by the use of Hypericum tincture. Now, there is one thing to know about Hypericum tincture, and that is that in addition to relieving depression, it also causes the liver to function much better. It especially helps the liver to clear chemicals from the body. And, well, gee, those drugs you're taking are chemicals. And so when you take Hypericum tincture and take a drug, the drug is going to be leaving your body sooner than it ordinarily would. And I usually say, well, if your goal is to be not taking this drug, then the Hypericum is just moving you more quickly toward that goal.
Mm-hmm. Well, there you go. And that you answered her second question, which was, I would like to take St. Joan's wort think it would be a wonderful ally, but contraindicated for the Lexapro I'm taking. So I guess that's why.
Right. It's not really contraindicated. It's just that the Hypericum is going to be working better than the Lexapro, and so the drug manufacturers don't want you to take an effective herb.
All right. So here's the next question.
I know hundreds of people who use Hypericum with Lexapro and every other anti-anxiety and antidepressive drug out there.
Well, all right. So you know lots of people who are saying that it's not a problem for them.
No. The drugs are cleared faster from their body, and again, they're saying, but that's what I want, is to be drug-free. I'm glad it's clearing it faster from my body.
Right. Makes sense. And that's what she was saying she wanted as well, so. Shall we go to the
On the other
question?
Hand, if you're taking a drug that your life depends on, don't take Hypericum tincture.
Right.
Right, if
like
you've had an organ transplant and you're taking anti-rejection drugs, don't take Hypericum.
And would you want to spend a moment talking about the what how to take what kind of Hypericum? Because I think that's really important here.
It is. And I go into great detail in the four shows that I did, but basically what I said was tincture only, and tincture of the fresh plant only. Not dried, not tea, not capsules, and not a tincture made from the dried plant. There is a constituent that is magnified by the drying of the plant that causes sun sensitivity. Now, I have used, goodness, over the time I've been working with herbs, I have probably personally taken over 2 gallons of Hypericum tincture. Sometimes as much as a dropper full every 15 minutes. When I was struck with a sciatic pain and had to drive to the city by myself and stand up for 3 hours and give a talk, I took a dropper full of Hypericum tincture every 15 minutes. And in the 2+ hours it took me to drive from my home in the Catskills down to Manhattan and park, my sciatic pain was completely and totally eliminated, never, ever, ever to come back. So I can tell you from my personal experience, there is no sun sensitivity ever caused by taking the tincture. I taught a class on Hypericum. There were 40 people in the class, and I asked those people if any of them, consulted or gave people advice, and every single one of them raised their hand. When I asked what their average, or general client load was, and it was about 100 people per person, although some had far greater client base and some lower. So we figured we represented about 4,000 people in that room. And I asked if anyone had ever seen sun sensitivity from working with Hypericum. I figured this was a group that was very interested in Hypericum because there was a whole class on it. And one woman raised her hand. The whole class kind of turned toward her like, iron filings going toward the magnet. And, because nobody else had ever seen sun sensitivity. And I said to her, what form do you use Hypericum in? She says, well, capsules, of course. And the room erupted because she was the only person in the room who used capsules. And I doubt that she could hear what was being said, but everybody was saying, no capsules, don't use capsules. It's not safe to use in capsules. It's not safe to use dried. And that's certainly my experience as well. You've used Hypericum tincture, yeah, Justine?
Yes, love it.
In sunny places like Costa Rica?
What's that? Do I use it?
Have
in
you
sunny
used
places?
Hypericum tincture internally in very sunny places like Costa Rica?
Most definitely. Yes, of course. Absolutely.
Any sun sensitivity?
No, and I don't have any reservations giving it to my 5-year-old daughter either. I don't even have to give it to her, actually. She takes it herself. Thank you very much. And my husband as well. And I know lots of people who take lots of Hypericum tincture and never have any problems at all with any sun sensitivity. I haven't ever met anyone who had any problems with it by using the tincture that I...
By using the tincture of the fresh plant, exactly.
Right.
Right.
But unfortunately, it seems like there's a lot of misinformation out there on the internet, and for some reason, there's a lot of people producing and selling powdered St. Joan's wort, and why is this?
Well, here's my thought on the matter. When I first started studying herbal medicine back in the mid-60s, we felt very marginalized. We didn't think that anybody took us seriously. And one of the ways that we thought we could get people to take us seriously was we said that drugs are made from herbs. Now, it's not a lie. Drugs can be made from herbs. And actually, 100 years ago, all drugs were made from herbs, but not today. Today, drugs are made from a great variety of source materials, including hydrocarbons from petroleum. So we, as I said, we wanted recognition. We wanted to be taken seriously. And so we said, you know, well, of course, herbs work. Their drugs are made from them. And then kind of going along with this, we thought that by making the herbs look like drugs, by putting them in capsules, that people would give them more respect. I never have really felt comfortable using herbs in capsules, and even in my early days, I didn't. Partly because, oh, I might as well admit it, I'm really fussy about what I put in my body, and I like to, you know it from the ground up. It's why I keep a herd of dairy goats and make all of my own dairy products, and, you know, why I'm a part of a CSA, and I know the land my food grows on, and, you know, most of my food I've got a personal relationship with, so I just never felt comfortable taking an herb in a capsule, because after all, how could I even know what was in there? It's all powdered, you know, and it's pretty difficult to tell if it's the right herb. And this is one of the reasons, of course, why I do say that taking herbs in capsules is the most dangerous way to take herbs. Additionally, is the most expensive way to take herbs. And, gosh, that would possibly be worthwhile if it weren't the least effective way to take herbs. A kind of classic thing that we can see happen in Germany, where herbs are quite legalized and prescribed by MDs. And they do get different training than American MDs, although not a lot of herbal training, unfortunately. And the person who was in charge of buying the kava kava root, the idea that it was supposed to be root just somehow slipped his mind, and he bought kava kava leaf. And the kava kava leaf was powdered, put in capsules, and given to people. And while kava kava root is perfectly safe, the liver can't handle kava kava leaf. And they had over 30 people who went into liver failure, and a great many of them needed liver transplants.
How awful.
Nobody would have done that if they were actually using the kava kava root, because they would have seen immediately that it was the leaf and not the root.
Right. How terrible.
Yeah, it was pretty horrifying story. As a matter of fact, for a few years after that, it was pretty difficult to buy kava kava root because, of course, the headline wasn't kava kava leaf causes, you know, liver failure. The headline was kava kava causes liver failure.
Right.
Without a distinction between the leaf and root. And if that's kind of hard for you to grok, that one could be, like, damaging and the other perfectly safe, think about rhubarb. We eat the stalk of the rhubarb leaf, and it's perfectly fine to eat, but if you eat the leaf of the rhubarb, it will make you very sick.
Right.
And those are more closely together even than the kava kava root and the kava kava leaf, huh?
Yep. All right, so we have a few more to get through here, and it's 8:30, and we have a guest coming at 9. So let's get through a few more questions here.
Okay.
And everybody stay tuned for 9 o'clock because we have a psychic coming on, and that should be a very interesting interview, don't you think?
All as you go through, this is two things from India.
What?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah?
Oh. Uh-huh.
Well, I guess you weren't listening. I said we're having a guest at 9 o'clock who is
I did hear
psychic.
That, yes.
That should be pretty interesting, huh?
Yes, indeed. As a matter of fact, my favorite phone message on an answering machine was, "This is Madam, I won't reveal her name, so-and-so. Don't bother to leave a message. I'm a psychic and I know you called."
That is hysterical. All right, well, everybody, stay tuned about 9 o'clock. Susan, whatever you're saying, it's not good. You should stop that.
I was asking Amy to please go in the house because we're sitting out on the deck and to
okay.
get my green folder where the questions for the psychic are.
It's a muffled sound. Like I can hear
well, that's why I was trying to do it with my hand over the receiver so you couldn't hear me, which is why it sounded muffled.
Wasn't working.
I wanted to be sure that I had those questions in hand.
Can I have your full attention?
You do.
Are you
have
there?
My full attention.
Okay, good. I was just directed to your site by a new friend who has learned about my long journey of being ill but having no diagnosis. I know my body is lacking minerals and vitamins, but supplementation isn't working. I'm fighting a stubborn case of candida with Chinese herbs, and they have been working. I'm getting married on September 7th, and I would love to reap the benefits of nettle infusion. I'm also afraid that nettle could cause a detox reaction before my big day. Is that normal to have a detox or a bad reaction? I made my infusion yesterday, and when I drank it, I felt funny, nauseous, and hot. Thanks, Susan. I feel the universe guided me to you, so I hope and pray this will assist my body in getting back to a state of good health. Be well.
There is no such thing as a candida overgrowth. There's simply no such thing. Okay, let me moderate that a little bit. I have seen candida overgrowth in people who are maybe 3 or 4 days away from being dead. I have seen candida overgrowth in people who have been given such severe chemotherapy that it's totally wiped out their gut flora. But other than that, this whole idea of a candida overgrowth is, so far as I can tell, merely a hype promoted by naturopathic doctors to make a lot of money. Let's start here. There are 10 bacteria in your body, and my body as well, for every cell in your body. In other words, 90% of your body is bacteria. And we're counting candida in as part of that. So what can we possibly say about this faux diagnosis of candida? Only that I've never seen anyone following any naturopathic protocol ever regain health. There are, at latest count, about 10,000 different yeasts, molds, fungi, bacteria that inhabit the large and small intestine of human beings. We are beginning to see that the composition of the gut flora has very wide-ranging effects on us, both in our physical health and our emotional health as well. Now, a great many things that modern people do disturb gut flora. Candida happens to be one of the fastest reproducing of the gut flora, and it is a natural and normal part of everyone's gut flora, and people who don't have it are people who are very sick indeed. In other words, these would be people who've been given lots and lots and lots of chemotherapy, and yet I just said that giving lots of chemotherapy actually often makes candida grow. So it's very difficult to kill it because it is so important to our health. A person with no candida, indeed, would not be healthy at all. So what's going on here? Well, let's imagine this. Let's imagine that we are a group of 100 people, and a spaceship suddenly appears, and a ray comes down from the spaceship and takes half of us away. Now, we're a group of 100 people that have a very important job to do, and we can't do that job if there's only 50 of us. It takes all 100 of us. So what are we going to do to deal with the fact that half of us are gone? We're going to ask the 50 that we have who reproduces the fastest so that we can build our numbers back up to 100. And Candida raises its hand and says, I reproduce the fastest. And we say, good. You go ahead then and reproduce and fill in the spaces for all those things that have been removed. And as those things come back, because you reproduce fast, you also die very quickly. And so those things will crowd you out. So are we starting to get the idea here? And this is an idea that's not just true about candida. It's true about all so-called problematic bacteria. The only way that we can really deal with problematic bacteria is not by killing them, but by crowding them out with non-problematic bacteria. Right. So we must first of all bow to Candida and thank Candida for reproducing quickly and filling in that gap and taking care so that we're 100 strong to do what we need to do. But then we need to ask ourselves two very important questions. And they're almost opposite questions. One, what kills gut flora and how can I avoid that? And two, what promotes gut flora and how can I do that? So let's start with the first question. What kills gut flora? Now, almost everybody, when asked what kills gut flora, says antibiotics. And you're right. Antibiotics do kill gut flora. And so, let's not use antibiotics unless we really, really have to. But even the most conservative estimate says that antibiotics, oh, about 90% of the time are not really needed. So, you know, if you're considering taking antibiotics, maybe you would want to reconsider that. But most people don't think much further than that. When I ask them what would be something that you would use on a daily basis that would kill gut flora, I often get blank looks. And I say to them, well, let me make question a little easier. What is put in your water to make sure that bacteria don't live in it? And usually a lot of people in the group kind of widen their eyes and go, chlorine? And I go, yeah, chlorine is added to water to kill bacteria and microorganisms in the water. What do you suppose it does when you drink it? And they go, oh, you mean the chlorine is killing my gut flora? I said, yeah, and a lot more damage than antibiotics because you're drinking chlorinated water on a daily basis. So get a filter, or if you don't want to get a filter, chlorine's a gas. So you can just boil the water. It's one of the reasons that you use only boiling water for the infusions, because by boiling that water, you're boiling the chlorine out of it. Make sure to take the lid off the pan. You want to be sure the chlorine is gone. Boil it for a minute. Don't have access to fire for boiling water. Take your chlorinated water, put it in a container with a large opening, and let it sit out for 24 hours. You could stir it or shake it once or twice during that time if you wanted to, but the chlorine will dissipate. I think the thing that we need to kind of grok from this, however, is that chlorine is a gas. And therefore, taking a shower in chlorinated water, going swimming in chlorinated water, being in a hot tub in chlorinated water is going to kill vast amounts of gut flora, because we are breathing in the chlorine. It is not that the chlorine is seeping in through our skin. It is the chlorine is outgassing from the swimming pool, from the shower, from the hot tub. And we are breathing that chlorine in, and we breathe it into our lungs, and it then goes into our blood directly from the lungs. So it's said that we will get 10 times more chlorine from taking a 3-minute shower in hot chlorinated water than by drinking a quart of chlorinated water. Again, there are filters that can be screwed right onto your shower head to get the chlorine out. Not very expensive. Save up your money and get one. Really important for your health. Okay, people say, we got it. You know, only use antibiotics if absolutely necessary, and really double check that they're absolutely necessary, and watch out for that chlorine in the water. Well, that's about it, right? And I say, well, think about this. Are any substances ever put in foods to help preserve them? And again, people look thoughtful, and many of them start to nod and say, well, yeah, there are things put in foods to help extend their storage. This is called preservatives, right? I said, yeah. Preservatives. The preservatives kill microorganisms like the gut flora. So anytime you eat a food that has a preservative in it, whether it's apple cider with 0.1% of sodium potassium in it, or whether it's a breakfast cereal that has BHT in the lining of the box, or whether it's any other preservative that's put in food, it's put there to kill microorganisms, and it does a great job in your gut just as well as it does in the food. So this is one of the reasons that, unless it's a social situation, certainly when I buy food, I don't buy any food that contains preservatives. And when they made it a law in New York State that you could only sell cider with a preservative in it, I went out and bought a cider mill. I spent $1,000 to buy a cider mill so I could make my own apple cider, because they don't like to drink apple cider with preservatives in it. Okay, people say we got it. Antibiotics, chlorine, and food preservatives all kill gut flora. Anything else, Susan? Ah, yeah, now they're on the ticket. Now they're learning that, there may be things that they didn't quite notice. And I say, well, yes, there is something that's kind of considered herbal, although it's not really. It is made from plants, so I can understand why it's considered herbal. And there's a variety of them, and they're all antibacterial, antifungal, and antimicrobial. And, of course, what I'm talking about is essential oils. Essential oils kill gut flora, and they can kill gut flora by inhalation. In other words, if you put an essential oil on anything, or if you put a cream on your body that contains essential oil, like the chlorine, it will add gas. You will breathe it in. It will go into your lungs and thence into your blood there to directly kill gut flora. So these four things are things that I urge anyone who wants to keep their gut flora healthy to avoid. Avoid antibiotics, avoid preservatives in food, avoid chlorine in your drinking water or in your showering, bathing, swimming, so on water, and avoid all essential oils and all products containing essential oils, including toothpaste, mouthwash, shampoo, cream rinse, soap, body lotions. The other question then is, how do I build gut flora? What builds good gut flora? Well, I hope you're sitting down, because the answer is going to frighten you, shall I say. I have had this conversation with a great many people, and usually what I'm about to say is rather frightening to them. And yet those who have followed this advice get back to me and say, oh my gosh, I cannot believe it. I've been on this anti-candida diet. I've been taking these supplements. I've been doing this for 3 years, 5 years, 10 years. One woman, 20 years, was doing these things with no real improvement in her health. Stopped doing all of that stuff. Stopped trying to get rid of candida. Started bowing to candida and thanking it for helping her. Saw to it that the four things I just mentioned, antibiotics, food preservatives, chlorine, and essential oils, were removed from her diet and her environment, and started building good gut flora, and she found that she was in complete and total health within 8 days. Now, what could possibly be frightening? Well, what could be frightening is that people who have this pretend disease, candida overgrowth, are told that it's caused by eating the very things that I am going to tell you to eat. I am going to tell you to eat mushrooms. I am going to tell you to eat food-grade mold. What would food-grade mold be? Blue cheese, camembert cheese, brie cheese. That's food-grade mold. Get some mold in your diet. I'm going to tell you to eat home-brewed beer and home-brewed wines. I'm going to tell you to eat sauerkraut or kimchi if you prefer it. I don't like what peppery things do to gut flora. Not good, not as bad as our big bad four, but not so good, so I do prefer the sauerkraut, or any kind of lacto-fermented vegetable. So basically, our gut flora consists of molds, yeast, bacteria, and fungi, and what I want you to do is to build gut flora by eating molds, yeast, bacteria, and fungi. Now, the second half of your question was about detox. Not only is there no such thing as a candida overgrowth, there is no such thing as a detox reaction. Stinging nettle contains large amounts of chlorophyll. And many people, when they first drink something that has so much chlorophyll in it, do feel nauseated, especially if they drink that stinging nettle hot or room temperature. I urge people to drink stinging nettle ice cold and literally poured over ice. And this completely eliminates that kind of nausea feeling that you have. And I'm very experienced with drinking lots of green things and eating lots of green things. And I must tell you that I definitely feel like throwing up if I am forced to consume hot nettle. I won't. I will not drink hot nettle. It's just horrible as far as I'm concerned. So ice cold nettle, it's not a detox reaction. There is no such thing as detox reaction. This, again, is something made up by naturopathic doctors so that they can make a lot of money. All right. You said that not only did you feel nauseated, but you felt warm. And that warmth, of course, is from the energy in the stinging nettle. I often say that stinging nettle is the energy of the earth. It comes into our body. It rebuilds and repairs the adrenals and the kidneys. And, yes, definitely makes us feel warm. How wonderful. Not detox. Health. Nourishment.
Ah, well, that was a rich answer.
Indeed, but we still have time for a few more.
Yes, we do. I am 49, 50 in December, was widowed 25 years ago. My baby died. I gave up hope of finding love. However, by miracle, I discovered my late husband was not dead after all. To cut a long story short, we're now back together again, and I am desperate to try one last time to seal our bond in the form of a child. I particularly want to try herbal remedies and would be very much liking your advice. Furthermore, a number of years ago, my husband started suffering from impotence. He did nothing about it, as he felt without me there was no need for him to be virile. But now I feel he's decided he can never do it again, and even though the first night after we got together he made love to me, he's not been able to since. Can you help us and recommend which of your books you feel would be best?
Did I miss the age? Oh, 50. She's going to be 50.
Correct.
I'm a little at a loss as to what to say. My first impulse is to say, you're crazy to consider having a child at this age. And especially given the things that you've just said. And sealing a bond with a child doesn't really work that way. You have a bond or you don't have a bond. Actually, having a child can often destroy a bond between a man and a woman. Have you ever seen that happen, Justine? I certainly have. I've seen over and over again that a woman gets pregnant and has a baby, and she's more focused on the baby, and the man feels very left out, and he leaves. So I don't think that there is wisdom in cementing your bond by having a baby. In fact, I would advise you exactly the opposite. You haven't said where you are vis-a-vis menopause. And if you are not completely done with menopause, it is possible for you to get pregnant. But again, realize that both your eggs and his sperm are far from being healthy. Not because you're unhealthy people, but because you are older people. Eggs and sperm are ideally meant to create babies sometime between the ages of 15 and 30. And after that, the quality falls off dramatically. Women in their 30s usually will have miscarriages. Women in their 40s will always have miscarriages because the body is choosing not to have eggs. So what I need to say to you so that you can really hear this clearly is if you decide that you are going to become pregnant, you are going to not become pregnant once, but you're going to become pregnant many times, and you are going to lose all but one of those babies. Are you and your husband prepared for that? Are you prepared to deal with the grief of losing pregnancy after pregnancy after pregnancy? If not, find another way to cement your bond. Adopt a child. There are many children in the United States and worldwide who need loving parents. And in fact, I find that adopting a child does far more to bring a couple closer together than having a child. That said, and that is my heartfelt advice to you, is do not do this. Adopt or find some other way to make a bond. Nonetheless, I will tell you that taking Vitex tincture, 2 to 3 dropperfuls, 2 to 3 times a day, can reset the biological clock and make it easier to become pregnant. And that drinking red clover infusion, 2 to 3 quarts on a weekly basis, and both of you can do the red clover. He would want to stay away from the Vitex tincture, however, will vastly increase your chances of becoming pregnant. Neither of these herbs can do anything about the state of your eggs or the state of his sperm. And so while you will get pregnant, if your body decides that that pregnancy is not good enough to carry to term, you will miscarry. I work a lot with older women getting pregnant, and there's a lot of work that we always have to do around the grief that comes up as they lose pregnancy after pregnancy after pregnancy. We can get you pregnant, but we can't do anything about keeping that pregnancy until your body decides it's good enough. I'm so glad you found your husband. And wow, am I curious about how you thought he was dead and he wasn't. Oh my goodness, what a story there, huh?
Okay.
Amy was
so
successful.
Except for the fact that she said they're not having sex, so I'm not sure really how they're going to have a baby at all. But maybe that's too, right? Yeah,
right.
I don't know.
She asked about a book down there. All right, the Pelvic Health Handbook would be the one because it has a whole chapter on herbs that can be used for men who are dealing with erectile dysfunction. And the new menopausal years, The Wise Woman Way, has a chapter on fertility after 40.
Mm-hmm.
So those would be the two books that I would suggest.
All right, great.
I mean, the obvious choice also would be Wise Woman Herbal for the Childbearing Year. But
mm-hmm.
I'm suggesting down there and menopausal years because these partners, assuming perhaps incorrectly, that her husband is of a similar age of her.
Mm-hmm. All right, so here's another one for you.
Did you know that Amy was successful? She found my green folder, and here are all the questions for Elizabeth Joyce.
Oh, great. Yay. Wonderful.
Good.
So
we're
happy.
Set to go when she comes on.
Except that Kim emailed and said she wasn't sure if she's coming or whatever. So, you know, hopefully she'll be here, and if not, we'll just keep answering these questions.
Okay, it's a deal.
Yeah. Are there any warm-up exercises that you do in the morning, and what would you suggest for me? I used to do yoga every morning, and I felt great. It helped to warm and awaken my body and especially my brain. I recently learned that you recommend yoga only once a week after the body is warmed during the day. Previously, before the year I started practicing yoga in the mornings, my routine would be 45-minute run, after which I also do feel great, relaxed and with a calm, clear, and focused mind. I understand that you have said that running on a daily basis is unhealthy, and what you said makes sense to me. What do you do in the morning, and do you have any other suggestions or ideas about waking the body and the brain? Love to you.
Usually when I wake up in the morning, I pick up the book that I was reading before I went to sleep, and I read some of it. Then I get my smartphone and I check in with my games and see what has happened overnight with my games and bring them up to date. I do Hay Day, which is lots of stuff that needs tending to in the morning, and My Town, which just needs a little bit of tending to. And then I get up and I go outside and I milk the goats, and I come back in and I strain the milk. And then the goats and I go out. And so that's what I do in the morning. All of my teachers have been very clear that the body is not really designed to stretch or run or do anything strongly physical first thing in the morning because, as you say, it's not warmed up. The muscles are cold. And we don't literally mean cold. We don't mean if you stuck a meat thermometer in your muscles that they would register cold. They mean that they're stiff. Right, they're stiff because you've been laying down all night and pretty much not moving around at all. And so any, what my teachers call violent physical exercise, which would be running or yoga, is more likely to tear the muscles than to strengthen them. Now, granted, strengthening the muscles does recall tiny tears to the muscle, but we're talking about massive injury to the muscle when we are doing these things in the morning. If, however, that's something that seems to work for you, I certainly wouldn't want to get in your way of doing it. I have done an hour and a half weekly yoga practice for 50 years. I started doing it when I was about 18, and I'm not quite 68 now. And during that time, I have seen a great many people jump into yoga, do yoga every single morning for a year or maybe two, and then totally abandon it. So far as I'm concerned, and so far as all of my teachers have been concerned, we get more from what we do if we can sustain it over a greater length of time. So my teachers believe, and thus I believe, that doing yoga for an hour and a half once a week for 50 years is far more effective than doing it for 15 minutes every single day for 2 years. Most people simply cannot sustain a daily practice, and even if they could, they're so likely to injure themselves. And this is what I have seen with a great many people, I would say thousands of people, who jumped into yoga, doing it first thing in the morning, and had a major injury. As a matter of fact, the person who turned me onto yoga can no longer do it because she's injured herself in such a way that she simply can't do yoga at all. And that's sad to me. I would like to see us be able to do yoga in our 80s, 90s, however long we live. And we do that by being kind to ourselves and not forcing ourselves to hew to some idea about warming up our muscles. Of course my muscles are going to warm up. I'm going to get up. I'm going to be moving around. My blood is going to be circulating. Well, it's an ordinary part of the day. I don't think that there's any Aboriginal group of people I've ever met with that do any kind of physical exercise that's useless first thing in the morning. And by useless, I mean like, you know, just doing something to do physical exercise. They might do something. They might like walk to the river to catch a fish, or they might like grind some corn to have it for breakfast. They might do something, right? But it would be something toward an end, toward feeding or taking care. They're not just to be exercising. And yet most Aboriginal people are extremely fit. And would never depend on doing something out of what the body would ordinarily do in the morning. Hope that helps.
Okay. So let's see.
We're going to have our yoga class for the Green Goddess Week tomorrow night. Wednesday night's my yoga night.
Elizabeth Joyce, is it Elizabeth Joyce, the name of the guest who may be coming this evening, the psychic?
Yes.
And what's the area code for her phone number?
Let's see if I can extract my sheet of paper out from under the cat.
Oh.
Of course, a sheet of paper. How perfect.
All right.
Must be a
I'll find
for me
mine
to
first. Here I am in the
okay,
other room.
Okay, her...
215. Okay, I just want to look and see if she's called in here. No, don't see that. Okay, so let's go to the next question. And this is actually the last question. So think about if there's something you want to talk about for a little while afterwards. Maybe there's something that... that you want to share with us about the Green Goddess Week or something that you learned today with the students or something after this question in case the guest doesn't come.
That sounds good. There's also a question that you printed out for me that I haven't answered that I could ask Amy to get for me.
Okay, good, perfect. And so here, there's
and that question is in my basket, the basket I take to Justine.
Okay.
Sheet of paper laying right
so
on top there.
Kind of two questions
go ahead.
Here. One of them says, on your article on nourishing infusions, you have nutritional information on dulse. And it seems like unusual chromium and selenium levels, other nutritional info on dulse I've found state lower. What's the source of your nutritional information?
Let's have a little background here. The amount of any nutrient in any food is going to be different depending on when that food was harvested, how that food was handled after harvest, what kind of soil or water, in the case of seaweed, the plant was in, and what part of the plant we are using. So the idea that there is a certain set amount of nutrition in any one food, like corn has this many, you know, calciums and this many vitamin A's and so on, is kind of absurd. It's simply not true. The usual thing to do is to test more than one sample and then to take an average of that sample and to publish that as what is the nutrient content of the food. But in fact, the nutrient content of any one food can vary by almost 100%. In other words, one sample might have 50 milligrams of something, and another sample might have 100 milligrams of the same something. So the information on seaweed that I was using was from Japan. And there is quite a lot of selenium in the waters around Japan because Japan is a volcanic island. And volcanoes bring selenium up from the magma. So whenever we're in areas where there are active or even extinct volcanoes, there's always going to be more selenium. For instance, I live here in the East Coast in the Catskill Mountains. Well, there's been no volcanic activity here for probably close to a billion years, and our soils are very low in selenium. The further west that I go, the more selenium I'm going to find in the soils once I get west of the Rocky Mountains. So the whole part of North America, from the Atlantic Ocean to the Rocky Mountains, the soils have not a lot of selenium. Once we cross the Rocky Mountains and start going toward the Pacific Ocean, well, what do we find? Volcanoes, earthquakes, rah, 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 all kinds of stuff going on, and those are soils that are high in selenium. As a matter of fact, because I wanted more selenium in my diet for a few years, I actually bought my garlic from the West Coast because garlic is a great concentrator of selenium.
I want to interrupt you for a minute here. Can I? Okay.
Please.
Elizabeth, if you can hear this, please push the number one button on your telephone. I get an email from her saying that she's looking forward to the interview tonight at 9. And so I am believing that she should be calling in or have called in already, and I'm thinking that it might be a good idea for us to call her. I can call out from the line here. Should we go ahead and try to do that, Susan?
That sounds good to me.
Okay, I'm going to dial her number now and see if I can't connect to her.
Shall I read the little intro here while you're doing that?
Yeah, why don't you do that?
Okay, born as one of two sets of identical twins, Elizabeth Joyce has been psychic since birth. Named one of the world's greatest psychics by Citadel Press in 2004, she is a spiritual healer and gives personal psychic readings worldwide. Ms. Joyce is a professional astrologer, a spiritual counselor, an energy healer, a medium, and a clairvoyant who interprets dreams and teaches about the new energies of the fifth dimension.
Right now, but if you leave your phone number with area code.
Ah. Well.
Who dat?
What's that? That's her answering machine. Hopefully.
Oh, it's her answering machine.
That's her answering machine. So hopefully she can hear this. Hopefully this is recording and she will hear this and call us right away. If she's calling from another house or a different line, oh, look, she's called in. Okay,
yes.
Wonderful. Here we
Bye.
Go. Yay.
Okay.
Hi, Elizabeth.
Okay.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. Okay, Susan, I'm going to take off now, and you can finish doing the intro, and I wish you two a wonderful evening.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Elizabeth,
love
I
you.
Want to warn you that we are on a timed show.
Okay.
And I have no control over it. In other words, I cannot make the show go 1 minute or even 1 second longer than it's going to go. My guest last week seemed very miffed. because there was something he wanted to say, and I had said to him, 2 minutes till the end, 1 minute to the end, 30 seconds to the end, and he ignored all of those things and didn't give his website information.
Well, luckily, I do a radio show.
Yeah, and actually hung up on me in kind of a snit. But I just want you to know ahead of time, I'm not in control of it. Can I finish your wonderful intro here?
Could I just ask you a question? How long is the show?
25 minutes.
Okay, got it.
25 minutes.
Now, all right.
On with the show.
On with the show. Love you, Justine.
Love you, too.
Okay. Elizabeth Joyce's TV appearances include Unsolved Mysteries, Beyond Chance, and The Psychic Detectives. Mrs. Joyce's books, Psychic Attack, Are You a Victim?, Ascension, Accessing the Fifth Dimension, and Ascension Workbook are available at all booksellers. Elizabeth facilitates healing classes using divine seals and spiritual chakras. In 2007, Elizabeth Joyce founded and now heads the Bucks County Metaphysical Association in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. Elizabeth Joyce has a radio show called Let's Find Out on bbsradio.com every second Monday, every other Monday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Besides traveling extensively, Elizabeth Joyce is building a healing center and teaching intuitive awareness classes and fifth dimension spiritual intensive workshops. Her monthly lectures, Streaming Cosmic Energy, are well attended. Elizabeth Joyce lives in, you guessed it, Bucks County, Pennsylvania, as well as in Bergen County, New Jersey. Well, I guess if you're a twin, you have to live in two places. Is that true? Are you there, Elizabeth?
I am. How are you? Is that true? I have property. I have two offices, and I go back and forth.
And I said I must be because you're a twin.
Could be. Could be. I always have to buy everything in twos. It's really funny.
Right.
Everything.
So you say that you've been a psychic since birth. Does that mean that when you were born, you knew you were a psychic before you even had a sip of mother's milk?
I never had mother's milk, but I was born with a veil, and my grandmother knew that I was psychic.
Your grandmother saw the veil and said,
and
oh,
she
this
knew
baby
because she was a wonderful, wonderful shaman from Maine. And well-loved throughout New Hampshire and Maine and very well-known. And she knew when I was born. So I was lucky I had a teacher.
Yes, extremely, blessed to have that gift of a grandma who saw that and was able to nurture that in you. Do you think that everyone is psychic? Do you think there's only a few people who are psychic?
I think the world is psychic. I think it's part of our intuitive sixth sense. I just think we haven't been trained. We have not been trained, and we don't know how to proceed with working with the other energies because we're only taught the five senses. I'd like to see that change.
I would, too, and I completely agree with you. I do think that every single human being is indeed quite psychic, but that most people don't trust the information that they get.
Well, the religion gives them a lot of fear. The religion lies.
I'm sorry?
The religions give them a lot of fear. Religions like to keep control, so they don't encourage you to meditate or to expand your auric shield or to grow with the spiritual energies. They don't teach it. And it's been abused a lot also throughout the centuries.
Yes. In fact, some of my spiritual teachers have said don't mess around with that because it will delay your progress.
It will not delay your progress.
I completely, again, agree with you. I do not think that it delays your progress in any way. And I think this is especially important for women. Now, I can't say from a man's viewpoint, but I do think that this might be true for men.
Well, I think it's especially important for women. I think that's part of the love channel that we are, and I think it's part of the compassion and understanding that we have for others more than men do. Men are more left brain, right hand. They like logic, and they think of it this way. It's the women that bring the kindness, the love, and the loyalty, because when someone is sick, it's the women that sit by their side. It's the women that cook the meals. And you know what I think? I think that cooking a meal is one of the greatest acts of love that we can do for another person.
Oh, it makes my heart leap with joy to hear you say that. You know, I had a friend who worked as a psychic, and she said to me, you know, we're all sitting inside a barn, and I happen to be sitting at the edge of the bench so that I can peer out through the cracks between the boards.
That's cute. Yeah, we're
Isn't
all so
it?
Curious for our own growth.
Exactly. She said, but don't think that I can see the whole picture either. I can't. I can just see what I can see through my crack.
You know, it's funny that you say that. I want to teach people, if nothing else, that we can only grow psychically and intuitively as we are supposed to, whatever our vibration is, whatever our level is. That's in my book, Ascension, Accessing the Fifth Dimension. We all work through levels. There's five levels, and there's seven layers to each level. And we are where we are, and we go ahead by learning more love, more peace, and more harmony.
Yes, I often say that the apprentices, this is not a course in becoming the perfect human being. It's a course in becoming who you truly are.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, tonight is
and there's so many and there's so many interesting ways to find out who you are and to become more of who you are. And I was also saying this evening that basically what we're talking about here is healing through resonance. That we're not saying, I am going to get a bag of skills so that I can heal other people. We're saying, I am going to make myself whole.
Correct.
I am going to take care of myself. And then I will resonate. What were the words you used? Peace, harmony, love.
Peace, love, and
compassion,
harmony.
Mercy.
Right.
And by giving to ourselves, nourishing ourselves, by taking care of ourselves, then we resonate these things into the world. And then we are a healing force.
But this is a vibration. I use the word vibration. You use the word resonate. I want people to understand when I use the word vibration, it's the same thing. And the more that we can raise our vibration, which we can do through meditation, the more that we work on doing that, the more our fears and pain and hurts will fall away, and we can become more service to other people. So as we grow, then we can pull people up with us. Don't you agree?
No. And let me tell you why. Because you have just replicated what religion tells us. And you just said that religion interferes with this, and I completely agree with you. I don't want to be high. I want to be broad. I want to be deep. I want to be whole. Because high implies that there's someone inferior to me. So
well,
my goal is never to be high. My goal
That's
is to be broader,
said.
More encompassing, more vibrating, but never to be high, because high is from patriarchal religion, and I don't want it.
You misunderstood what I said, because what I said is exactly what you said.
Okay, but you use the word high.
I do.
And
I use the word
and
vibration.
And pull people up. And you didn't just say it once, you said it four different ways. So I really did hear what you said. In fact, I believe I heard what you said more clearly than you did. And I don't want to argue with you. I'm actually offering this to you as a gift of love and harmony because I so support what you're doing. And it's very easy for us to slip into these patriarchal white god things about being high. And I challenge all of us to rethink this and to let go of the idea of high.
I agree with you because that's competition.
Exactly. And what we want is to encompass more. To be broader,
Absolutely.
To be deeper, to be fuller. And also, as a feminist, I must admit that women have always been put down for being low and earthy. And men have been always raised up and glorified for being high and above it all. And I want my feet on the earth. I don't want to be high and above it all. And I think we totally agree about this.
Yeah, we do. I'm just saying in my generation, so I apologize.
No apology needed. Take it and run with it. Get broader, deeper. Let's do it. Let's bring more people into the fold. It's not us against them. It's not either or. It's everybody working together because we need this resonance. We need this vibration because where human beings are right now is at the edge of the cliff.
Yep, downward. Sorry about that. They're going to jump off a
well,
crash.
The ego falls up, doesn't it?
You know what my definition of ego is? Easing
no, I didn't
God
say
out.
Ego. I said ego.
Oh,
the
ego
okay. falls up. When an ego falls off a cliff, it falls up.
Up, always.
All right. It spreads its wings. So this is what we want. We're on the edge of a cliff. No, we don't want to fall down. We want to spread our wings. Now, you are working to help us spread our wings as we come to the edge of this cliff, yes? Am I understanding
so.
This? Yeah.
I hope so.
Yes.
It's in my life work.
That's exactly what I'm getting from you, is that you are teaching us to fly.
Hope so.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful thing if you can do it.
It is. So let's see. There's length, width, breadth, and time. Those are the four dimensions, right?
Time, you call time the fourth dimension?
I do.
I call
time the fourth dimension. My physics professor is called time the fourth dimension.
Okay. That's fine.
Yeah. So what do you call the fourth dimension?
Telepathic, for some reason.
Okay. And then the fifth dimension?
The fifth dimension is way beyond. The fifth dimension is pure love. We've never had the fifth dimension on this planet before until the 22nd of December 2012. We've never had the energies on the planet before, perhaps in Atlantis, but not since we've recorded history. And it is so fabulous. It is so wonderful that when you are able to tap into those energies, your whole consciousness changes, and it changes in an instant.
Yes, and everyone from Atlantis is back in a body now. We've all been called back.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's true. And that means that we've had the sorcerers come back as well as the well-doers.
So this fifth dimension is now available to us?
Yes, it's called the double helix. And the double helix is a new energy that's very difficult to access. You really have to be working on yourself and be very open to access the double helix. There's not too many people in the world that can do that yet. But that's what's coming, and it's a new type of healing.
Hmm. So was your grandmother your teacher for your whole life, or did you have other teachers as well?
I worked with Meg Stettner. I worked with Indira Ivy and the Clear Light Group. I worked with Louise Hay for 5 years, and then I worked with Deepak, as well as some other teachers.
And was your grandma your most important teacher?
I think she was. Well, my most important teacher was Amarita Nandamayi. But I think my grandmother was a pretty important teacher because I was only 5 years old. So when I went up to live with her for a year, what manifested in my body was TB. And so I was sent up to live with her for a year, which, of course, was an astral trick so that I could learn more. And it was an incredible time. Incredible. It's still vivid in my memory.
I'm sure it must be. So you left your parents' house and went to Maine to live with
your grandma.
New Hampshire. And was she in a city or the country?
She was in Warner, New Hampshire, which is halfway between Concord and Sunapee. But if anybody looks at New Hampshire, for the most part, they consider the entire state a country. It's certainly not New York.
In other words, they say there are no cities in New Hampshire. That it's all country land.
Concord and Manchester are, but it is mostly country, yes.
So was that also a change for you? Were you living in a more city environment?
No, I lived right outside of New York City. My father worked in New York for 49 years.
Right, so you were in a very urban environment, a very city environment, and then taken at the age of 5 into a far more country environment.
Correct.
Where your grandmother was probably, I'm just guessing here, tell me if I'm wrong, probably a pretty capable woman.
Oh, she was fabulous. You want me to tell you how she disciplined? Because it's a great story. When we did something wrong, she would look at us with that look, you know, that look that we get, oh, no, you can't not love me because I didn't mean to do anything wrong look. And she would hand us a mat, which we called a sit upon. And we would have to go outside and sit under a tree and lean against the tree and ask for the strength of the tree to give us the wisdom to understand what had happened, why she was upset, and that we were genuinely sorry. And then we would have to go back in and tell her. But it was like a meditation time. It usually took about a half an hour to 45 minutes to figure it out at 5 years old.
That is wonderful.
A woman who adopted me,
Yewino Two Wolves, a Native American woman, had exactly the same tree, same kind of thing. There's a tree in her front yard, which was the talking tree. And if you did something that she didn't like, she pointed to the tree, and you went and you sat under the tree until you figured it out.
She only disciplined you harshly if you had done something that would hurt another person. So when my cousin Chucky put fireworks on the railroad tracks and he was brought home by the ear by the chief of police, she gave him a knife and she said, go out and cut your switch. So he went out and cut his switch, and when he came back with it, she hit him with it. I think that's fabulous discipline, by the way.
Well, I think that it's very clear.
Yes.
It was very clear to your cousin exactly what was going on, right? That there's a possibility that he was doing something that was going to severely injure others, and your grandmother felt that pain would help him remember that.
Correct. Would help him understand. He was about 12 years old when that happened, and this was back in the 50s, so this was back in another era as well.
Yes, back in an era where it was considered child neglect if you didn't whip your children.
I guess so, but that's what she did. And it was just a fabulous, fabulous way. She taught us how to love animals because every lunchtime she would put on a big hat and a huge apron and put all kinds of food in the hat and in the pockets of the apron, and she would go outside, and my cousin and I would look out the window and watch her as she sat with her eyes closed for half an hour, and all of the animals, including the birds, would come and feed. That was her lunchtime.
So the bears would come?
Basically, there weren't bears there. There were squirrels, raccoons, birds, chipmunks, that type of thing. They were smaller animals.
So
were no,
small
no
animals. So
ones.
we're not talking bear, deer, moose.
No, smaller animals.
Okay, good. So I was just reading about how many Americans are killed each year by being stomped to death by moose.
Oh,
I had no idea.
I
had no idea that moose had short temper and could stomp a human being to death. Kind of scary, isn't it? Ooh, my goodness.
Trouble.
So I do want to mention before our time is up that you can find Elizabeth Joyce at www.new-visions.com if you're interested to learn more about the fifth dimension, about this pure love, if you're interested in learning about psychic things. If you're interested in, let's see, I think you said that there were five dimensions that you work with and seven layers at each dimension?
Correct. There's
12 dimensions. I knew I got part of that wrong, but there were seven layers in each of those 12 dimensions. Now, telepathy is the fourth, and pure love is the fifth, and then there's a sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth, tenth, 11th, and 12th?
That's right.
Are those accessible to us?
We're just starting. We have something called the spiritual chakras that have just come on the planet in the past year. We have 12 chakras now, actually 14 instead of 7. And I have that all depicted in my workbook, what they are, how to work with them. I wrote a wonderful mantra to invoke the chakras, and you can get that at bbsradio.com. And also, if you need any of the diagrams, you can just send me an email, and I'll send you what it looks like. We're really working with the eighth chakra and the ninth chakra with humans at this time. If you're opening your eighth chakra, not only will you see more clearly and have more of the violet color, but you'll be given more spiritual gifts. Each new chakra gives you spiritual gifts. And the tenth chakra is the heart center of the universal body. So when the 10th chakra, which is amber, comes down to the heart center, which is the golden yellow, then you really vibrate to a higher feeling of love.
To a richer healing of love.
That's good.
To a deeper healing of love. To a broader healing of love.
Yes, that's, those are good words.
To a wholer healing of love, but not higher.
It's all the same.
Not the same. There's a whole freight of religious stuff that goes with higher. So I do not find it at all the same, especially not when I am speaking to people and reading their energy. When I start talking about higher, their energy is really different than when I start talking about deeper. And deeper seems to open the heart chakra, and higher, in my experience, closes it.
What I mean when I say that word, and I'm sorry I said it again, it just seems to be a part of me, it's how I describe things, is that it is richer, it is deeper, and it is more knowing.
Yes. Again, no apology. It's just an awareness. And, you know, because we grew up in similar times, in similar decades, my feminism has just made me very aware of the kind of white patriarchal religion that has been stuck in my brain that makes me think that faster is higher. And that higher is better.
As a woman
and a feminist, I have made it my life work to reclaim deeper.
Absolutely. I agree with you.
Yeah. So no apology needed. Just, you know, observe and see what you can do to wipe that white male god out. Because I think that I totally agree with you. That white male god, well, you know, I was on an airplane and this person turned to me and it was right after that horrible tsunami. And he said, you know, those poor people there, I'm going to bring Jesus to them. And I looked at that man and I said, Jesus has brought more death and destruction to this planet than any other single human being. And I can't believe you're going to go take advantage of these people. Now, I'm not anti-Jesus. And there's certainly a lot of great things that are done in the name of Jesus. But we also have to admit that horrible things have been done in the name of patriarchal white male high gods.
Well, I think what was also going on, if you want to hear my side, is he was a male chauvinist and he thought he was really doing something, which was an ego response.
And not that pure love.
This is Justine, and I'm back here with you, and you have 2 minutes and 23 seconds. So, Elizabeth,
yes.
You just have a few minutes to talk with the audience about what's most important to share, okay?
Okay. So what's most important to share to me is being able to grow and expand in your spiritual truth, to understand what the process of soul growth is, and to not be afraid of it, and to understand also that one of the most important things that we can do on the planet is help others. We have power. We have power wherever we are, whether we're a slave or whether we're the boss of a corporation, it doesn't matter. We have to find a way to heal ourselves, to rejuvenate and transform ourselves and others, and to be in enlightenment. When we walk into a room, it would be nice to go beyond the mind and just be the light so that other people would say, I see that, or I know that, or maybe I would like to know what that is. We are light beings, and we can heal and transform the soul first. And if we heal and transform ourselves, then everything else will follow. And that's what I believe in.
That is so true, and that is such pure love that you are giving us. Thank you. So once again, this is Susan Weed speaking with Elizabeth Joyce. You can find her books, Unsolved Mysteries, Psychic Attack, Ascension, and the Ascension Workbook. And her website is www.new-visions.com. Elizabeth Joyce, psychic, here to help us access all 12 dimensions, all 7 layers of those 12 dimensions, and to be the full experience human beings that we can. We applaud you and support you, Elizabeth Joyce. Thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure.
Green blessings to everyone, and thank you so much for joining me again here at Blog Talk Radio to reweave the healing cloak of the ancients and reclaim herbal medicine as people's medicine.
Good night. Thank you, Susan.
Oh, good night, Justine. Good night, Monica Jean. Mwah. Kisses and love to both of you.
We love you. Good night, everyone.